HW Media.
The report is in. The FBI's annual report on active shooters for last year. The numbers are not good. There's an alarming 52.5% increase in active shootings, and there are many, many more casualties. The FBI designated 61 shootings as active shooter incidents last year. 103 people were killed, 140 wounded. These casualties represent almost a 50% increase over the previous year. The number of active shooter incidents for 2021 also represents almost 97% increase from 2017, just 5 years ago. 2021 saw the highest number of deaths since 2017. That's a 171% increase from just the previous year. Shooters ranged in age from 12 to 67. The FBI also says they observe an emerging trend. That's active shooters who are roving shooters, who shoot in multiple locations, either in one day or in various locations over several days. The FBI also notes its support of the Don't Name Them campaign. This campaign encourages media, law enforcement, and public information officers to shift their focus from the perpetrators of active shooter incidents toward the victims, survivors, and heroes who stop them, as well as the communities that come together to help in the healing process. I can't think of a better episode for this week following this disturbing report than to replay an episode from our very first season, my interview with the then head of the FBI's Threat Assessment Center, where we discuss the FBI's in-depth study of each and every active shooter, what they take away from that study, what they're doing about it, but most importantly, what you and I can do to identify and report the warning signs and indicators that someone is on the path to violence. Let's take a moment to thank our sponsor, Avast, for supporting the Bureau. Avast's new all-in-one solution, Avast One, helps you take control of your safety and privacy online through a range of features. Learn more about Avast One at avast.com. Now back to the podcast. I'm former FBI Assistant Director Frank Figluzzi. Join me on a journey deep inside the world's premier law enforcement agency to decode the mysteries and challenges of today's FBI. The threats facing America are as real as the men and women who battle to protect us. In this first-of-a-kind podcast, we sit down with active duty FBI personnel who reveal their mission, their cases, and their lives. Let's go inside the Bureau with Frank Figluzzi.
Parkland, El Paso, Vegas.
Listening right now, someone may have some deep concerns about a coworker, a neighbor, even a family member.
These offenders, as they plan, prepare, and consider for their attack, don't do that in a vacuum.
What makes violent people tick?
A sense of growing desperation or hopelessness.
And you feel certain that something bad would have happened but for that intervention.
If they've never done an attack before, they're going to have to learn how to do it.
Get inside the heads of those who do this.
What's driving this particular person down that pathway?
Our guest today is John Wyman, chief of the FBI's Behavioral Assessment Center. He'll take us behind the scenes into the research and the lessons learned from studying some of the most tragic acts of mass violence in America, from school shootings and lone offenders to international and domestic terrorists. The FBI's threat assessment experts work to assess the violence that's already happened so they can stop the violence that may lie ahead. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for having me.
John, I want to start by asking a little bit about your background, where you've come from, and your journey into the FBI. And I know from our prior discussions that You're part of a family legacy of law enforcement. Tell us about your background and how you came to be in the Behavioral Assessment Center.
Sure thing. I guess my journey to become an FBI agent and my career here in the FBI started when I was really young. My dad was an agent, and I grew up with him as kind of moved across the country from place to place, and really kind of, I think, set the seed for my desire to go in to the Bureau later. Studied finance in college, and after about four and a half years in investment banking, that bug had never left, and I was applying for the Bureau the same time I was applying for grad school. And fortunately for me, the Bureau came through it first, and this the best career anyone could ask for. Came in about 98.
1998. And where were you assigned since then?
I was assigned to the Washington field office, mainly as a result of the embassy bombings that occurred in Africa at the same time I was at the academy. So I originally had orders to one office, and they asked for volunteers to go to the Washington field office, who was going to have a heavy lift on some of the extraterritorial terrorism cases. And I volunteered to go to WFO instead. So I started at Washington field. I was assigned to a terrorism squad there. Actually, it was the squad at Washington Field that dealt pretty much with all of the overseas Sunni-based terrorism threats, so including Al-Qaeda, and worked there for a number of years before going over to headquarters and working in the counterterrorism division there, bounced back to WFO and then down to Richmond, where I led some led our JTTF, Joint Terrorism Task Force squads, both at Washington Field and at Richmond. So just from a timing standpoint, ended up working terrorism. I didn't have any experience in studying the topic before coming into the FBI, but just because of the time, the way it all worked out, and starting off in that unique position at Washington Field, that really became my career's focus until I came to the Behavioral Threat Assessment Center a little over 4 years ago, and moved up here from Richmond and assumed the role of the chief of the Behavioral Threat Assessment Center, where we work on a holistic view of the threats that we face, from counterterrorism to other acts of, say, targeted violence or personally aggrieved offenders.
Yeah, it sounds like a logical segue from investigating violent terrorists to now heading up an effort that investigates what makes violent people tick. Tell us more about the mission of your unit, its unique mission with relation to the other behavioral analysis units, and what your men and women of your unit attempt to do every day.
Sure. So we are one of four operational units at the behavioral analysis units, all anchoring back to that, to the foundation or the bedrock of research and specialized training to support our operational experience. So all of the things that I brought to the table when I came, as well as the people that work in my unit, they come with a really vast and deep amount of experience working, investigating these types of cases and situations. But then when they come in, we layer on top of that this additional specialized training, and we conduct our own research within the BAUs out of an additional research-focused unit. And so we put all that together in order to try and help those seeking our assistance. So in my case, at the Behavioral Threat Assessment Center, that would be our FBI field offices or our state and local partners who are dealing with some of their more challenging, complex, concerning cases, and they want some of our additional support. That would be similar to the other units. We're a resource for our state and local partners across the U.S.
So it sounds like a large part of what the unit does is research and analysis of past violent events with an eye toward learning enough to get inside the heads of those who do this and help identify warning signs, indicators, and whether or not someone's on a path to violence. Do you deal across the board, across the spectrum with acts of violence? Is it just terrorism? Does it go beyond that? And what are the parameters of what you'll look at in your unit and what is, perhaps is not within the scope of your unit?
Yeah, good question. So we are unique in that as well, is that we look broader outside of just the, say, the counterterrorism or the threat of terrorism, which would be based on the goal of using violence to bring about social or political change. Our unit assists on cases beyond just that, where it may be, say, you mentioned before, right, like your school shooter or your personally aggrieved, say, a workplace violence offender, or just your threat in the community of someone who is planning, considering, contemplating a potential act of violence to resolve whatever underlying drivers and motivators that they have. We work it all out of one unit because really there are similarities that span across in the way that these events can be prevented. And that's our focus. The focus of our unit is in prevention. We look back through research, you know, at other cases so that we can learn from them, so we can take those lessons learned and we can share them all in pursuit of this idea of prevention. And, you know, in addition to the research, it's really important what we learn from our operational experience in the unit. So, you know, every week we've got 6-10 new cases coming in that we're having to work through, problem solve, and we learn a ton from those. And we also deploy out to some of these bigger events, and we'll support the investigation on the ground, but then we'll also, in certain cases, take a deeper dive into that offender and what brought them down the path, all with this effort to bring it all together and to provide that best consultation service to those looking for our help.
So where do these cases come from? You mentioned, you know, consultation, looking for help. This isn't just FBI field offices. This is support of state, local, county, even tribal law enforcement. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's right. Right. Yeah. So the terrorism cases, obviously, those are going to be coming in from our Joint Terrorism Task Force investigators from across the country. And they're working in that Joint Terrorism Task Force environment with their state and local partners. But it's an FBI lead, you know, on the investigation. But similarly, persons of concern or potential threats will bubble up at the state and local level, and they may not fall into the parameters, the right and left, you know, limits of what the JTTF is, but they're still a threat. They're still a concern. And really, if you think about those potential school shooters and the school shootings that we've seen in the past, the same diligent, focused, structured approach to trying to prevent acts of terrorism can be applied to preventing these school shootings as well. And that's what we help out. So the locals will bring their case into us through one of our threat management coordinators, and we'll have a series of conversations with them, go back and forth, look at the data, gather more data, and really just try and problem solve the situation together.
You mentioned school shootings and across the board, these other tragedies of mass violence. What are some of the high profile, without getting into the details of the findings on each of these specific instances, what are some of the high-profile events that our listeners might quickly identify with that either you personally or your unit have deployed to?
Sure. So many of the big events that have occurred over the last several years, we've had one role or another in. That could be you know, just in remotely providing that support to the field, but. But for some of the more significant ones, say, you know, if you look at Parkland, El Paso, Vegas, the shooting that occurred in Dayton, and most recently even down in Nashville, Tennessee, the explosion there, we'll deploy out people to embed with that investigative team to work with the local field office and their partners in order to try and bring to bear some of our experience and also to try and pull in additional information, again, so that we can learn from these and get better as we move forward.
Yeah, I think everybody listening wants you to succeed. They want you to learn enough lessons to apply across law enforcement to help get out in front. Let's talk about some of those commonalities. You mentioned that there are certain things that apply across the board, perhaps to those who reach the flashpoint of violence. And you also produce a publication This is not secret information. You get the word out on what you find. Talk about how you get the word out, and most importantly, talk about what you're finding in terms of the warning signs, indicators, commonalities of those who commit this kind of violence.
Sure. So getting the word out is critical. It doesn't do us good if we just keep this information back here and we don't share with our law enforcement partners, our non-law enforcement partners, say mental health professionals, probation and parole, the judiciary, you name it, right? All these other stakeholders that are involved in prevention. It's critical that we get this understanding that some of that these events can be prevented. And you look at what we call bystanders. Obviously, the sooner we can learn about a person's potential journey down the pathway towards intended violence, the better. The quicker we can observe that, recognize it, and ideally report it, the better. And some of the bystanders that are going to be in the most critical place for seeing those early warning signs are your family, your close friends, and your peers. Obviously, there's a role for authority figures like bosses and maybe religious leaders in there as well, and even strangers, right? So think of the see something, say something. But we want to get further left of that event in order to identify, recognize, and report. So some of the ways that we do that, recently, we put out our Lone Offender Terrorism Report, which was a research study that we did here in the BAUs, which looked at 52 ideologically motivated offenders. And we studied the offenders, their attacks, and the bystanders. And then we also, a year prior to that, we had another report that we put out on the pre-attack behaviors of active shooters. So looking separate from the ideologically motivated or the terrorism cases, taking that same look in order to try and find out what are those behaviors that we want the bystanders looking for? What are the key warning signs or the triggers and stressors that we should be on the lookout for so we can get those reported and actioned appropriately?
Breaking news out of Georgia tonight, and I have to warn you, it is disturbing news, and this is a developing story. 7 people have been shot and killed in Georgia tonight in the Atlanta metro area. At least 2 more people have been injured in what appear to be connected attacks. NBC's Atlanta affiliate has just confirmed that police do have a suspect in custody now in connection with these shootings, that confirmation coming just in the past few minutes. Police say the shootings occurred at 3 different locations, again, all in the Atlanta metro area. All 3 locations are massage parlors.
John, listening right now, someone may have some deep concerns about a coworker, a neighbor, even a family member. What has been learned about the warning signs and indicators? What can you share with the public about identifying whether or not someone is moving toward violence? What are some of the commonalities you see?
Yeah, that's a great question, Frank. So I'll say that, our research across the board, so I've talked about lone offender, active shooter, and really any of the other research that we do shows that these offenders, as they plan, prepare, and consider for their attack, don't do that in a vacuum. And even if they end up alone at the end, that doesn't mean they started off alone. There are bystanders around who see this concerning behavior and for a whole host of reasons may decide, or they take different actions. So some may just rationalize the behavior away, trying to think positively and say, it's just John being John having a bad day, right? Or some don't know where to report it and they might not have confidence in what they're seeing being a concern. And so we see that lots of bystanders who see and even recognize that as concerning behavior, they don't go and report it to an entity that can actually do something with it. So law enforcement being one of those best avenues of reporting, but there are other avenues as well. And the key is sharing that information, but getting the bystanders over that natural inhibition, maybe to say, this is serious enough to go tell someone about. And what we've seen is, even though in, you know, the offenders start off from a different place. They travel down this same pathway where they've got to do things to say research and plan and prepare for their ultimate attack. And some of the things that they're going to be doing along that way are going to be observable by these different bystanders. Some of the key things, as I mentioned before, like the family, those people that are closer to them are going to be able to recognize these contextual changes in behavior. Anything we see or observe in a vacuum, like that one particular data point, is very difficult to figure out how concerning it is. And that's what you're getting at with, say, some of the see something, say something campaigns. Someone lays down a backpack in a crowded subway station. That's something you could recognize just by seeing that one behavior. But what we want to do is we want to broaden out that aperture, and we want people to be able to see, hey, there's something going on with this person I'm concerned about. So these changes in behavior, someone who used to be able to handle setbacks or grievances, problems in their life well in the past, now just isn't being able to do so, right? So there are people that are voicing indications that violence is the solution to whatever the problem is. It could be a, you know, social or political, but it could be a personal problem that they're having. And giving out indications to these bystanders or those around them who can see this idea that the person of concern is really considering, contemplating, or viewing violence as that necessary and justified solution. You know, having a bad day, nothing wrong with that. And we're not talking about that here as to what we want people to report, but we want them to look at what are they saying about violence, and what are they saying about the idea or the thought that there's this impending crisis or last resort coming. Like, I'm going to be left with no other options but violence. A sense of growing desperation or hopelessness. Those types of indications can be observed in many different ways. Could be verbal, right? Just through conversations, things that they're saying. But there are other ways that we see from the research and from our experience where these types of indicators leak out. And we call it, the term is called leakage, the term of art. It's information that maybe could be written down in a school journal, would show up in an art assignment from school, but then also lots of times we see it online. It'll appear in posts made on social media or in message boards that have some sort of more of a nuanced type indication that something bad is happening, that there's violence on the way. And oftentimes it's these forms of leakage that become really clear when you look at them. You look at them in hindsight. Hindsight's 20/20, and the challenge is to recognize that leakage, that concerning behavior, those non-specific or non-direct threats, in their context with the other changes in behavior that are mentioned. And that's having one person get all of those data points is difficult, and that's why we need it to be reported, so that other people can gather in the additional information to put around the observed behaviors and get a true sense of the threat and the management strategy.
Let's take a short break, then get back to exploring the path to violence. Let me share a word about a critical topic. My entire career has been about safety and security. You've heard me say before that cyber is the new battlefield. And that battle plays out every day on our devices and computers. Avast is a global leader in cybersecurity for more than 30 years and trusted by over 435 million users. Avast empowers you with digital safety and privacy. No matter who you are, where you are, or how you connect, you can enjoy the opportunities that come with being connected on your terms. Avast's new all-in-one solution, Avast One, helps you take control of your safety and privacy online through a range of features. You can learn more about Avast One at avast.com. Now, here's why I like what Avast has to offer. They've got firewall protection that keeps personal information secure and prevents attacks that seek to access our computers and steal our data. They've got ransomware protection that secures our personal photos, documents, and other files from being modified, deleted, or encrypted by ransomware attacks. Avast prevents over 1.5 billion attacks every month, And with Avast One, you can confidently take control of your online world without worrying about viruses, phishing attacks, ransomware, hacking attempts, and other cyber crimes. Learn more about Avast One at avast.com. Now, let's return to our guest. And we're back with more of our discussion with John Wyman.
A couple other things that people should be on the lookout for, right, as someone moves along that pathway in that research and planning preparation stage. They're going to be trying to enhance their capabilities. If they've never done an attack before, they're going to have to learn how to do it. So have they never been interested in acquiring and shooting guns, and now this is a passion of theirs? Are they trying to learn about chemical combinations and ways to make explosives that have no connection to really the rest of the world? And concealment. Are they trying to hide their activities? So if someone is planning and preparing to conduct an attack, they're not going to want other people to know about it. So are there certain areas in their life that they're now blocking off? Are they having conversations with people in a way that they're concealing that they have never done before? And some of the warning signs that we see at the end that really are important is that end of life type planning. Are there things that they're doing and saying that it would indicate that they think they're not going to be around anymore? And are they creating in the present day things that would help them be remembered in the way they want to be remembered? We call them legacy tokens. So are they preparing things to leave behind that other people would then recognize later after an attack as like, oh, that's why this guy did it, right? So if we can observe these things early, the earlier the better, and we can report it to someone who can actually do something about it instead of just keeping it inside, then that's where our prevention efforts are really enhanced, and we can manage and mitigate these threats.
John, I think you may have just helped some people really wrestle with the difficult question of whether or not to seek professional help or law enforcement assistance for someone who is troubling them even right now. And you ran through a litany of great insights to include all under this heading of what you call leakage of insights. And I wrote some things down, a sense of hopelessness. Maybe someone's using that kind of language of despair, that they've reached the very end, nothing left to do. Violence has become the solution, the answer. They're talking about that. There's signs of planning some kind of event, violence. Maybe they're even purchasing a weapon or talking about how they would do it. And then there's you mentioned an element of secrecy and now becoming kind of clandestine and hiding or compartmenting off certain things. All really good stuff. And I think you were really careful, and it's important to note that any one of these data points in themselves wouldn't necessarily be significant, but when you start multiplying them, and then when you throw in stressors of life that might just be really coming down on people, what are some of the common stressors? Not only all these indicators that something's happening, but the person being surrounded with certain stresses of life on top of this, do you see certain commonalities going on in people's lives that just magnify the stress?
Yes. So that's a terrific question, because everyone, as they, our research and our experience is showing, that the decision to move along this pathway and to ultimately act is going to be highly personalized and individual to that offender. And those life stressors and really some of the triggers that we look for when we're assessing these threats are really important. So you've got the concerning behaviors that you look for and you bring in and you try and gather as much data as possible, but then you're going to look at, all right, what's weighing on this potential offender? And our research shows that when we look back at some of the studies in our active shooter report, the offenders in the year preceding their attack had 3.5 or so different significant stressors going on in their life. So it's this breeding ground for the ideas and the belief that violence is necessary and justified. That foundation is set on this bedrock of stress, the stressors or these risk factors that are going on in somebody's life and things that are weighing on them in a way that they get to the point where they've got this growing desperation or hopelessness. There's nothing else I can do. And so some of the key stressors that we found through our research, and it consists across both, you know, all that we've looked at is, one is just mental wellness, right? And I'm not saying mental illness or diagnosed mental illness. I'm just talking about mental wellness or a lack thereof. Are there things going on in their life that are causing them to feel depressed and anxious? Are they having some kind of paranoia or delusional beliefs? Are there things that are making them more fragile in their thinking and the way that they handle stress or cope with stress? How's their resiliency? Just that mental outlook as to how they're dealing with problems in their life. And then some of the other stresses then, logically, when you think about these, are going to be their interpersonal relationships, their interaction with peers, students, coworkers. Are they having problems at school, be it with grades or discipline or at work? You know, where do people spend their time? Around who do they spend their time? And that's where you're going to see, at least from our research, where some of those significant stressors are coming from. And the offenders that we look at who are resorting to violence for their solution often don't have the ability to form these kind of pro-social relationships or pro-social life outlook that would keep them off the pathway to violence. Think about financial stress right? So with the pandemic, the global pandemic, those are additional stressors that are weighing on people. Those would be some of the biggest ones that we see, or the most, you know, these health stressors or mental health as well, that we would see weighing on people as they move along and they just decide that they can't handle it.
Yeah, makes sense. And you're right. We're living in an environment of stress right now, perhaps unprecedented in most people's lifetimes. So things are exacerbated. How does this all play out practically in the field? So let's say that a field office or a police department out there wants an expert set of eyes on a case they're working, an individual they're concerned about. How does it work? How does a police department get hooked up with your folks?
So in the last couple of years, we've really tried to streamline this process and push forward some of the capabilities that we have back here at the Behavioral Threat Assessment Center out to the field. The big effort really started after the shooting in Las Vegas in 2017, and then Parkland in 2018. And out of our unit, we've brought back from across the country, I've brought back coordinators who we've now designated as threat management coordinators in each of our field offices. And we've provided them with an additional 3 weeks of training back here in Quantico, and then redeployed them back to the field to go out and to establish these relationships in the community with law enforcement and some of those other key stakeholders that I mentioned before, including mental health, social services, probation, parole, your prosecutors, right? So these agents have now come back. They've been trained up and pushed back to the field as threat management coordinators. And their job is to go out there and establish these relationships and be that point of contact in their area of responsibility, so that when your local sheriff's office, your police department, has a problem, personal concern, they know where to go. They've already talked to this person. They already know the capabilities, and they can go and they can bring that to them, and they can start problem solving out there in the field. And if necessary, they can escalate it back to get our support here. You know, we're a limited asset. Even though we are a national asset, we have a limited capability back here to support all the threats. There are a great number of threats across the country. And so what we want to try and do, the vision is to really try and build the capabilities to use threat assessment and threat management teams across the country in order to be able to use the same sort of structured process we do to assess and manage the threats. Always having the ability to escalate or move it back to, you know, get our support if needed in some way to build these teams across the country. And we're leaning on those threat management coordinators and our key state and local partners that are involved in this lane of responsibility.
And do you view the counterterrorism agents out there, the FBI agents who investigate terrorism every day, what's your interaction like with them? They are that kind of front line. They're sitting across an interview desk, perhaps, every day with someone who might act out. Do you offer them your insights and training?
Certainly do. Absolutely. So some of those threat management coordinators that I mentioned will also be agents sitting on our Joint Terrorism Task Force. They don't have to be. It's their rep from the office, but we've seen a number of the agents that come back to serve as that office's threat management coordinator are sitting on the JTTF. And where they're not, there's a real solid link up between our TMC, threat management coordinator, and the agents on the JTTF, because we can help support some of their cases as well. Before they go into that interview, before they make some of these other decisions, we can use the same types of threat assessment and threat management techniques to help them with their investigation. You know, it's real important that we try and as effective or as accurately as possible to assess that threat. What, going back to everything we've just talked about, what's driving this particular person down that pathway? Because if we could figure that out, then we can come up with some really good management decisions. And one of your best management decisions for someone who's a really high concern, who's moving towards a potential attack, is using that criminal judicial process, right? Our tried and true arrest, prosecute, and convict. But oftentimes, the cases that we see, the ones, especially the ones that come back to us, are the more challenging ones where maybe the evidence just isn't there yet, but we're really concerned that this person's moving forward. Or for some of the younger people, like juveniles, or maybe when there is mental illness at play, are there other non-traditional types of management strategies that could be used, leveraging some of our other partners? So we definitely, across the country, you know, those cases that are getting worked off the Joint Terrorism Task Force, while we don't manage them, our counterterrorism division manages them, we help out in a consulting role on those cases on a day-to-day basis.
You know, I always ask about success stories, and in your line of work, it can be difficult to measure success in the sense that you never quite know what hasn't happened because you intervened. But is it fair to say that there have been cases where some form of law enforcement intervention occurred because of your work, your involvement, and you feel certain that something bad would have happened but for that intervention?
Absolutely. You're right. It's hard to measure success because it's something didn't happen. So is it because of what we did or is it because of other factors? It's easier to measure failure. And we certainly don't ever want that to happen. But we know with certainty, you know, based on the cases that are coming through and what we see on a weekly basis, we've got some really high concern cases that we're helping support. And it's a team effort. It's our team back here, but the rubber meets the road out there in that community, at that JTTF, the local police department, and those other stakeholders that we kind of bring together and we build on an ad hoc basis to manage this person of concern. That's where the real hard work comes. And there are a lot of dedicated professionals working across the U.S. on this every week. And acts are absolutely being prevented because of the efforts of this combined team.
Yeah, that could be satisfying, very satisfying work. Tell us about those dedicated professionals that are in your unit. Who's in this unit? What's the background? I'm sure there are young people listening who are saying, this is fascinating to me. What's the pathway to doing this kind of work someday? Who are your colleagues?
So we're a multidisciplinary team. So we've got experienced investigators from the FBI and from partner agencies. So ATF, HSI, the Marshals Service, Capitol Police, NCIS, you name it, right? So we've got experienced investigators, people that have grown up through the ranks of their own agency. And then in our case, the FBI, experienced FBI special agents who spent years and years working and investigating these cases. And that's really important. Before they come in here and we layer on all the additional training and research, we got to know that these folks have been out there, they've been there and they've done it. They've put together cases. They've sat across the table during these interviews. They've written search warrants, right? And we bring them in and then we give them this additional training, but we support them through a team of similarly experienced intelligence analysts and crime analysts, and then also some administrative support personnel. And then what's really unique here is we have contractors who support the BAUs across all the BAUs, mainly from, you know, the mental health professions, right? So operational psychologists, forensic psychiatrists, and other partner agencies, but then also medical doctors on staff. So we can go to them. And when we put together our team to analyze and assess the problem, we know we've got the right people looking at it. No one's guessing. And if we don't have the right people on our team or on contract, we're going to go find them. If there's this unique religion or cult or something that's driving or motivating somebody, we've got connections in all these different organizations where we can pull someone in if needed in order to accurately assess that threat. So people don't come right into the unit right as they first get into the FBI. I often find myself talking to younger people that say, hey, I really want to go work for the FBI behavioral analysis unit. What do I do to get there? And I say, well, first you need to get the experience through the FBI or through other activities that are going to make those skills relevant to the team back here. And you've got to bring that experience with you, and then we can build the rest of it. So don't just join the FBI to go into the BAUs. Go into it to become an analyst, some other sort of investigative support type person, or an FBI agent, a general FBI agent. And if your goal still remains to someday work for the BAU, that's a possibility, certainly is. But it's not something you just go into right off the bat.
Yeah, it makes sense that you want folks to have the kind of street cred necessary to not only get it right, but also to have credibility with the local state detectives, many of whom are really seasoned homicide and other investigators.
Right. I mean, when you're talking to them about an interview strategy on this really concerning case, or how to go, you know, get a search warrant for a particular thing, you've got to know what you're talking about. And these experienced investigators out in the field, they'd see through someone that's just going based off of what they read in a book, right? That's why we lean on that experience before we bring people in.
That makes sense. Let me ask you about a hot topic today throughout our country and even the world, and that's the topic of domestic terrorism. Is there a common theme toward radicalization to violence, regardless of whether it's a domestic terrorist you're looking at or an international terrorist? Do you find common motivations, drivers, stressors, and the kind of common leakage that you've talked about? Tell us about any commonality there.
Right. I mean, the ideology is important. Trying to find out what's motivating, what's the belief system that your person of concern has. You know, when we're assessing that threat, it's going to make us smarter on how to manage it. But we don't want to ask bystanders or other people out there to really have to try and become experts on what those ideologies are. And it doesn't take a knowledge of the ideology or what the belief system is to recognize those concerning behaviors we talked about, or those life stressors or the leakage. That's going to cross the board, and that movement down the pathway is going to be the same for your domestically motivated violent extremist as just as much as your international motivated violent extremist, or your personally aggrieved. As we talked about before, a lot of the same behaviors that move someone down that pathway are going to be the same. And the ideology mixes with all those personal life stressors as well. It creates this complex cocktail of risk factors, stressors, beliefs that are causing someone to believe that violence is necessary and justified. And that's where you just go back to that violence piece. It's okay to have extreme nonviolent type beliefs, and many people do, right? It's where those beliefs move to the idea that violence is necessary and justified to solve the injustices or the problems that are affiliated with that belief system.
Yeah, it's all about the path to violence as opposed to studying what someone thinks just for the sake of studying their ideology.
Right.
Sadly, John, it seems like as the threat has grown closer and closer to home, you and your colleagues will increasingly have examples and case studies to study. And we want you to succeed. We want you to prevent the next act of mass violence in our society. Thanks for joining us today, John. And go back to the unit and thank all the men and women of the Behavioral Threat Assessment Center for what they do to protect us every day. Thanks for listening to Mass Attacks, The Path to Violence. It's been a somber discussion on a somber topic, and we live in somber times, times that call for all of us to be more engaged, more aware, more vigilant, to report when our gut tells us that something just isn't right. I hope you picked up some takeaways, some action items. I hope if you ever encounter someone near you, someone in the neighborhood, someone at work, someone in the family, and you can't get them to professional help, that you'll identify the warning signs and indicators, and you'll pick up the phone, and you'll call law enforcement before that person gets to their flashpoint. Don't wait. Don't be that person who says, I knew something was going to happen and I did nothing. Join us again next time as we continue to take you behind and beyond the Bureau with Frank Figlusi.
The Bureau is written by Frank Figlusi and executive produced by Allison Gill, with sound design and editing by Molly Hockey, with podcast art design by Johanna Coxeter. Music for The Bureau is written and composed by Peter Rydberg. The Bureau is a proud member of MSW Media Network, a collection of independent creator-owned podcasts focused on news, politics, and justice. For more information, visit mswmedia.com.